Countrywide on ABC Radio.
Support businesses are going to go to the wall just like dairy farmers will.
We've seen the whole agricultural community come out.
Once people leave communities, they generally don't return.
Countrywide.
Don't worry about me. Go and speak to your farmers.
We're already losing businesses.
Get out there and speak to your farmers today. And be gumboots on.
Countrywide, the politics of food and farming on ABC Radio.
Hello, Brooke Neindorf with you. Thanks for your company. Coming up over the next half an hour, when we talk about the importance of protecting the world's diverse ecosystems, the role of bees, plants and animals are often discussed. But what about fungi?
We've done some work over the last couple of years on sort of looking at the conservation of fungi and the sort of threats to them. And for the first time a couple of years ago, some fungi were added to the IUCN red list of threatened species. So they've been pretty much overlooked until recently, but it's apparent that fungi, just like other organisms on the planet, are threatened by things like habitat loss and climate change.
We'll look at that very shortly. Plus, some new research has found trust in the ag industry is dependent on things like environmental responsibility, responsiveness to community concerns, and the importance of products produced by rural industries. More on that study shortly.
From the top end to Tassie, Countrywide on ABC Radio.
But first today, the dairy industry is ripe for expansion with rising herds, strong prices and a wave of corporate investment. But could a persistent skill shortage stifle growth? Sheffield Farm School in Tasmania's northwest has been cultivating the next generation of dairy workers for decades. But a multi-million dollar redevelopment has allowed them to show students the reality of dairy in the 21st century. Lachlan Bennett has the story.
For decades, young Tasmanians have been learning the dairy trade at Sheffield Farm School. But following a multi-million dollar redevelopment, the 50-year-old dairy was replaced by a technological operation. Assistant Principal Jamie Skirving says they now have a place that better reflects the nature of the modern dairy industry.
Well, obviously there's a lot of confidence in the dairy industry in Tasmania, and I think we really needed to bring our dairy into the 21st century. We've had an old dairy that serviced the farm for many, many years, but to show the students what the dairy industry had to offer, we needed a new facility that was better suited to teaching and learning, and obviously bringing them a bit closer to what the reality is of working on a farm these days.
Because it's not just cups on, cups off, there's a lot of other things that go into it.
Yeah, lots of things to consider. When we designed this dairy, it was about it was for teaching and learning. So the two parts to that, obviously you've mentioned the cups on, cups off and the hands-on element of it, but also understanding the technology that supports dairying these days. So the data that we can collect from our animals and learning to increase our productivity and our milk production.
And what's, the availability of workers like for the dairy industry at the moment?
Well, our Certificate 2 course, lots of students gain employment from the course, directly from the course, go into apprenticeships on farms. So we're seeing a lot of demand for that. So the next stage, I suppose, for employment is for the students that may want to pursue an agribusiness pathway. So they might need a little more knowledge around, you know, animal production systems in general and how they actually need to analyse the performance of their herd, growing pasture, animal health. There's a lot more things that students can perhaps learn at this site and then move on.
And how does Sheffield Farm School fit into, I guess, the job ecosystem of dairy?
We've tried to specialise in that dairy production so that, you know, we do a lot around animal production systems here. So we have beef cattle. Obviously, we've got a fully commercial dairy farm. We have some lambs and we raise some pigs. So we don't try and do everything, but we're really focusing mainly on our dairy system.
And it's really about, I guess, showing the pathways as well.
Yeah, it's the early stages of learning for kids at school. It's about food, where their food comes from, so food and fibre. Our high school students is about making connections to what are the potential career opportunities, and then obviously our older students in 11 and 12, it's really nurturing that interest in agriculture and hoping that they can find a career path that suits them.
One of the students who is keen to pursue a career in dairy is 17-year-old Crystal Joyce.
I'm doing the Agriculture Cert 2 here, which is just at the Sheffield Farm. It's a lot more than I thought it was going to be. I thought it was going to be something little, but it's turned out to be a lot more and a lot more exciting than it was actually meant to be. But yeah, I think it's big. It's definitely educational, and yeah, so it's definitely fun as well and learn a lot of stuff.
So what do you do here?
A bit of everything, kind of milk the cows, get cows out of the paddocks whenever I need to, and feed out. We're working with sheep as well. We've got calving and lambs for this month.
Before you started doing this, what did you think of the dairy industry?
Well, I just always thought it was just milking and that was it. So I just thought it wasn't going to be as more pushing as it was until I actually got into it. And I was like, well, there's a lot more into this than I actually thought there was.
Are you thinking about maybe a career in dairy?
Yes, yeah, definitely trying to look for a career in it, yeah.
What is it about the industry that you like?
The animals, definitely cows, getting to know different personalities in them and working with different people. So, yeah, there's a lot of opportunities. There's always something open.
And this is a new dairy. What do you think of all this equipment?
Yeah, well, it's awesome. Yeah, it's very different to the old dairy we had, and it's changed so much. And it's a lot more room and everything. Yeah, so it's a lot of buttons and stuff to press, but putting the cups on, sometimes there's a cow that's got something special that you've got to press a button to make sure the cups come down, or make sure that the cups are on longer because the cows have more milk than some others.
Is this what you thought milking would be like?
No, not at all. When I first started, I thought you still just put cups on and with your hands, which you still do, but put the cups on and that's it. But there's a lot more to it than I thought there was going to be.
Aspiring dairy worker Crystal Joyce chatting to Lachlan Bennett about learning the trade at Sheffield Farm School in Tasmania. Now, attracting more young people into dairy is one challenge, but keeping them in the industry long term is another. Workforce retention has been a big focus for Tasmanian farmer Mark Griffin, and he believes it's vital not only to the industry's future, but to his own farm's profitability.
I think we underestimate the true value in high retention rates and the amount of time we spend on training new people. And I think we as an industry have to put more emphasis on maintaining people and giving them pathways to opportunities and providing them flexibility and valuing their other endeavours and hobbies outside of the workplace.
And that's been a big focus for you on this farm here.
Yeah, it has. So our retention rate in the past 5 years has been 100%, and that's something we're very proud of and something we're looking to maintain and keep at a very, very high level. And we think that we can be a lot more profitable as a business overall by maintaining that high retention rate, and also that it gives our staff more consistency in their lifestyle as well.
Because hiring someone to come work at the farm is just the first part of the journey, really.
Absolutely, yeah, it is. So yeah, hiring new people is great, and it does provide fresh eyes for the business, but it does come at a cost in having to teach them all the different skills that are required, and especially the larger the scale, the higher the impact on the business.
So what sort of things are you doing to try and keep those workers here?
So the things we're doing is understanding what commitments our staff members have outside of the workplace to be able to provide a flexible roster so they can have a strong work-life balance. Other things we're doing is valuing their opinions within the workplace as well, and making sure that everybody knows their opinion's valued and that they can also have a say in the future progression of the farm as well. And also the other thing would be just being super approachable as a manager as well, and making sure that people feel comfortable to have conversations with you about everything.
And what role does training play in all of this?
Training plays a massive role. So do a fair bit of on-farm training ourselves, but we also lean on other educational sources, i.e. TIA and Dairy TAS as well, and TAS TAFE, to be able to put our staff members through lots of different courses. So the education's not just coming from their manager or their boss, it's coming from third parties.
What's happening in the industry at the moment in terms of workers?
As an overall industry, we're struggling a little to maintain people in the industry, and I think that's certainly something we all have to work on. I think it's something that won't be changed overnight, but I think if we get into schools early enough and we can educate kids at a young enough age that there is a very viable career in agriculture, and there's a lot of opportunities there in dairy, that we'll see that turn around. And I think owner managers have to take a lot of responsibility in that as well, and upskill themselves in that educational aspect to make sure that we're doing our part to maintain those people and retain those people in the industry.
And retention's that key focus for you?
Absolutely it is. Yeah, it is. And whilst retention's a key focus, I think as businesses, we should be benchmarking ourselves to upskilling our staff members as well. So if they want to take that next step into management or share farming, that there is that opportunity for them. Perhaps it might be not on the farm they're on currently with yourself, but it might be on another farm. And I think it's an important one that we look at as well.
While Mr. Griffin has kept all of his staff, he's also been able to attract new members, like Nepalese migrant Ruby Mahazan.
It's been like almost 6 months I've been working in the dairy farm industry. I always wanted to do agriculture business as my career plan. So I thought the dairy farm would be a great opportunity for my future growth and my career plan.
Well, Tamar farmer Ruby Mahazan talking to Lachlan Bennett about her plans for a future in dairy.
From the paddock to the plate, Countrywide on ABC Radio.
Brooke Neindorf with you. Thanks for your company. Now, when we talk about the importance of protecting the world's diverse ecosystems, the role of bees, plants and animals are often discussed, but fungi is often left out of the conversation. Dr. Tom May is one of Australia's lead fungi researchers, and he says climate change could devastate the organisms, which would have disastrous flow-on effects.
When I saw the latest IPCC report, I was thinking, okay, what's going to happen to fungi? So we've done some work over the last couple of years on sort of looking at the conservation of fungi and the sort of threats to them. And for the first time a couple of years ago, some fungi were added to the IUCN red list of threatened species. So they've been pretty much overlooked until recently, but it's apparent that fungi, just like other organisms on the planet, are threatened by things like habitat loss and climate change. So I was thinking fungi, like they're a really big part of the natural world. It's a whole kingdom. There are possibly millions of species. So what was going to happen to them? And I think that one of the things that come up is that we just don't know because we don't have a really good baseline knowledge. But it's important that we do know because there's lots of ways that fungi interact with people, with agriculture, with forestry, with industry and so on.
Fungi needs very specific environments to prosper. With the predicted rise in temperature and other elements of climate change, what do you predict will happen?
I think the key to understanding what will happen with fungi is that they are intimately connected with other organisms. So they get their food either by parasitizing other organisms, stealing food from them, or many fungi form symbiosis with other organisms. So, for example, a fungus that has a host, so it might be a plant or an animal, what happens to that plant or animal will determine what happens to the fungus. So all the things that threaten different plants and animals are then threats to fungi. And those interactions are really interesting because there's a lot of unpredictability about that. We might, for example, we could see with, say, plant pathogens of agriculture, as climates change, that means that there are parts of the world that become suitable for pathogens that at the moment can't occur there because it's too hot or too cold and so on. The increased severity of weather events creates more turbulent, you know, for example, cyclones and so on that might blow spores around. So there's definitely are threats to fungi, which are similar to other organisms, but those interconnections they have with other plants and animals, we don't fully understand all those interconnections, but it means that we do need to pay attention because of the possibility of new pathogens popping up in places that they haven't occurred before.
Are people listening to this thinking maybe something along the lines of, oh, so what, we won't have as many mushrooms? A fungus more important to the ecosystem than just being a source of food, for example?
Yes. So, you know, there's a biodiversity component in a forest. There's the beautiful coral fungi and bracket fungi and mushrooms and so on, and we need to look after them. But fungi are really critically important to human health and well-being in a number of areas. So they're sources of biologically active compounds like antibiotics and so on. And this is proven sources, things like penicillin, cyclosporin and so on. These are really important drugs that have come from fungi. Fungi are living in the soil, competing with bacteria and viruses and other microorganisms. And they're really good at making compounds that are biologically active. And we go to them for ideas. So nature is a source, a storehouse of ideas. And there are millions of fungi out there that are yet to be discovered or documented or described, and they hold potentially many solutions. Also in industrial processes, fungi are often used to make compounds in various ways. They're really good little factories, and we see that from, you know, brewing with beer and wine and so on. The fungus is a factory for the alcohol in the beer or wine, and there are other kind of similar industrial applications. So they're rather hidden and we don't notice them very often, but they're out there, and it's their sheer diversity that offers lots of promise. But we would have only documented maybe 5% of the fungi that we expect on the planet. So at the moment, the challenge is to do that documenting, understand them, discover all these roles at a time of global climate change when things are shifting and maybe we're losing some fungi without even realising it.
We often talk about the delicate nature of the ecosystem. One example would be around bees and how important they are overall to the biodiversity of the ecosystem. What role do mushrooms play in that aspect?
The big role that fungi play is hidden away so that the growing part of the fungus is in the soil. It's called a mycelium. And these are tiny, fine threads, and they're connecting up things. So most plants, whether forest trees or grasses, have fungi attached to their roots that are beneficial. And there's this incredible network going on where different plants are connected. There's flows of food and information. And that's all happening in the soil. We can't see it. It's only just now that we start to uncover the incredible processes that are happening there. And I think that's one of those fundamental ecosystem processes that we need to understand more so we can then conserve it and make sure that it's still operating in a functional way.
Dr. Tom May, Principal Research Scientist of Mycology with the Royal Botanic Gardens, speaking with Jane McNaughton. Still to come on Countrywide, how hard has it become to predict the behaviour of Australian consumers through the pandemic?
Mass panic buying at the start of the outbreak of COVID-19. People were just doing things that were very erratic and not what their normal patterns of behaviour had been in the past. But what we're starting to see now is the dust settle a little bit, and there are some trends starting to emerge that are, you know, related to the change we're all facing.
More on that shortly, having a look at fruit and veg during the pandemic. But before that, Australians believe fishers, farmers and foresters play an important role in society. However, there is a push to improve the trust they have in rural industries. A new study has found that trust is dependent on things like environmental responsibility, responsiveness to community concerns and the importance of products produced by rural industries. Lead researcher Dr. Kieran Moffat told Michael Condon that trust is crucial for industry and business because it translates community expectations and experience into acceptance.
The idea behind this project is to really try and understand the nature of the relationship that those rural industries have with the Australian community, the key drivers of trust in that relationship and where they need to be focusing to improve that position.
So what sort of industries are you talking about? Are you looking at where they're, you know, perceived issues with trust?
No, actually, it's a collaboration across more than 10 industries and research development corporations. So this is work that encompasses food and fibre, red meat, and also speaks to forestry. So it's farmers, fishers and foresters. So the full gamut is what we're interested to understand community attitudes about.
What sort of community attitudes are you finding you've liked? Is it a vegan agenda in regards to red meat? Is it, some issues with water use for rice or cotton?
Actually, we're trying to keep it up at the rural industry level so that those industries overall, what we've been finding in year one and then in year two as well, that the key drivers of trust have remained consistent, and that is that the more environmentally responsible these industries operate, the more trust community members have in them, the greater the extent to which they're responsive to community concerns, that they're listening and taking action based on those concerns, the greater the level of trust. And then actually, interestingly, the quality and the role that industry products play in our lives also leads to trust. And the higher the quality and the more connection that those products deliver for us to the producers themselves, the greater the level of trust community members have in them. And then in year two, what we also found is the emergence of a new driver of trust, which was distributional fairness, the idea that the Australian community get a fair share of the benefits that flow from rural industries, and in particular, that regional communities benefit and are supported as a consequence of the benefits created by rural industries.
Is there a feeling, though, you know, that there are still some problems that need to be overcome? Like, is there, you know, for example, as I mentioned there with red meat, so you're never going to convince all vegans to start eating meat, are you?
No, and I don't think that's the aim either. But you're absolutely right that there are concerns that community members have about rural industries. There are issues that are challenging, and we've been able to understand those in a little more detail as well. So things like welfare of animals is absolutely fundamentally important to community members, and there's really no room to compromise in that space. There's no sense that, you know, economic value or sustainability of an industry means that you can compromise on some of those standards. And the same with you, as you said, water is a key issue for many people, and how water is managed and allocated are things that people don't often know a lot about, the mechanics of that, but it's an issue that is very relevant for them and particularly concerning given the context of climate change. And all of that, however, sits in this context for rural industries where levels of trust in industries are very high and acceptance of rural industries are very high. So that's actually a fantastic platform to be leveraging something else we saw in the data, which is communities' real interest and motivation to see our rural industries globally competitive based on the technology that they implement, based on new ways and innovation attached to rural industries to try and solve some of those challenges and also to keep producing really high quality, excellent produce. So it's a really great point, an important point for industry to understand here, that they've got a platform from which to try new things and innovate and work into new spaces, particularly around some of those challenging issues, I think.
So is it the case then that they need to, the industry, general industries that may have issues or trust issues with the public, need to get their message out about what they're doing more, or is it the case they actually need to improve what they're doing and, you know, reduce the amount of water they use or reduce the perception about animal welfare?
Yeah, that's the great question, isn't it? And what we did in year two is to drill deep into exactly that question and ask community members, you know, what do you expect from rural industries when around issues that you care deeply about? And what was resoundingly clear is that community members expect industries to take action, that they really don't like it or trust industries when they're silent on issues that community members are concerned about. The action really is the language of trust. And that doesn't mean just sort of changing everything overnight, but it means having a meaningful conversation about the way issues are managed, the trade-offs that industries are needing to make every day, and to engage community members in those harder, more nuanced conversations. And what the data shows is that community members are able to do that. They're really willing to go there and to have that conversation. But what it takes from industry is a little bit of vulnerability to step forward into those spaces, to be open and to speak proactively about those challenging issues, not wait until something goes wrong.
So have the cotton growers out there talking about the amount of water that they're using, how they're saving water, how they're reducing evaporation, and have, you know, the abattoir, the meatworks, talking about their processes there and welfare protection there.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it, Michael, is getting out in front of those issues because it's received a lot differently than trying to be defensive or talk about how you're going to fix something after an incident.
Or talking during a crisis, for example.
Yeah, exactly. That's just exactly the wrong time to be building trust, isn't it? And so what we're seeing in this data and the recommendations and conversations we're having with industries is really about how do we help you guys to be out there proactively engaging on these challenging issues to create more space for benefit of the doubt and for goodwill to allow you to innovate and to move your practices along on a timeline that works for your industry and is in line with community expectations.
Dr. Kieran Moffat speaking with Michael Condon. Now, did you know that bananas enjoy the title of being Australia's number one selling supermarket product? But how hard has it become to predict the behaviour of Australian consumers through the pandemic? With sluggish demand and an exponential rise in online shopping, it's presented marketing challenges for all fresh fruit and vegetables, as Group Marketing Manager for Australian Bananas, Matthew Dwyer, explains to Charlie McKillop.
COVID-19 blew a lot of those trends out of the water. And you just mentioned we saw mass panic buying at the start of the outbreak of COVID-19. People were just doing things that were very erratic and not what their normal patterns of behaviour had been in the past. But what we're starting to see now is the dust settle a little bit, and there are some trends starting to emerge that are, you know, related to the change we're all facing.
And how is bananas and fresh food generally poised as that dust settles?
There's a lot of opportunity in that. If we think about health and healthy eating, fresh produce and particularly bananas have a massive opportunity in their natural goodness and everything they can pass on, and especially a lot of products that are related to immunity, which is very top of mind with consumers at the moment. I think the return of the weekly shop is interesting, and that it plays into the hands of bananas because 80% of purchases of bananas are planned. So people are putting it on a shopping list. So if they're going to the shops less often, it's important to be on the list when they're going and to get in the basket. And now an interesting one for fresh and bananas is the rise of online shopping. Now it's from a low base, but we're seeing a real exponential growth in that as a result of COVID. And one thing we have to really work on and to communicate is trust in someone else picking your products and it getting to you and being the product that you wanted.
Sure. So how do you foresee that these trends might play out for a category like bananas, which have such a high penetration anyway?
Yeah, that's one of the great things about bananas is 92% of households will purchase bananas. That is great, but when you scratch the surface a little bit on that, there is some room for improvement. Because if you look at penetration on a four-weekly cycle, so it's a shopping behaviour over a month, the penetration's really only 65%. So there's an opportunity to close the gap. We've got some room to get frequency, so how often people are buying bananas.
We have only recently been attending the Australian Banana Congress, as you know, and growers there were being told about the power of the brand, and particularly in terms of trying to establish a point of difference in the marketplace. How do you go about doing that when your banana is your brand, your product is your brand, basically?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question because we're marketing the category here, and the whole point of the program is to grow the category and grow value in the category. And the beauty of an RDC is that whether you're a big grower or a small grower, the investment in the marketing program benefits all. And what we try to do is increase the relevance of the product and the brand, Australian Bananas, in the lives of Aussies. And we do that by positioning it as a healthy, convenient and energy-packed snack. So if we can ensure that consumers know that the product is very relevant in their lives, the lives of their families, then we've got a greater propensity for them to have that as top of mind, to put that product into their basket. But also, if they see value in a banana, then they're more willing to weather the storm if prices go up, if there's issues with supply, or maybe we have some cosmetic impacts on the bananas. The idea is that the consumer will stick to the category.
Are you flagging that potentially we might see a new banana jingle in the near future? Something to make our bodies sing, maybe?
Well, we're always doing lots of stuff. We're looking to launch a new campaign in October in line with back to school and coming into spring to really raise awareness of bananas again with Australians and further drive that relevance in their lives. And really, if we are getting more Australians to buy more bananas more often, that's more bananas sold, and that's a contributing factor back to the profitability of a business, which, as you would know, has lots of factors which contribute to that. But if we can ensure that bananas are top of mind, then that's a great thing for Australian banana growers.
Matthew Dwyer, he's the Group Marketing Manager for Australian Bananas, speaking there with Charlie McKillop. That's all we've got time for on Countrywide today. You can find more of these stories online at abc.net.au/rural. And you can go back and have a listen to previous episodes by searching for Countrywide on your podcast app. I'm Brooke Neindorf. Thanks for your company.